the offenses are still occurring, the crimes are still occurring, we do not have the resources to prosecute all the offenses that come in the door. And so we have to prioritize.
Department of Law budget cuts stretch the limited number of state prosecutors. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the U.S. women's cross-country ski team head to the Olympics with a real chance for a medal.
I know that we are coming into this with a serious fighting chance, and we're going to be swinging hard.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Legislators in Juneau are hearing some hard numbers this week on how difficult things have gotten for state prosecutors. Violent crime like murder and assault and property crime, including vehicle theft and burglary, have trended upward in recent years. At the same time, the Department of Law's criminal division has been hit with deep budget cuts. As Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports, the state prosecutors want to rebuild so they can hold more criminal offenders accountable.
Crime is up all over the state. In Kotzebue, the increase is especially dramatic. The district attorney's office there is now handling double the number of cases per attorney than any other office in the state.
The Kotzebue office is dramatically underwater, and we have to get them more resources.
Deputy Attorney General Rob Henderson says the result, not just in Kotzebue, but statewide, is that district attorneys have had to prioritize going after violent felonies ahead of any other cases, including nonviolent felonies and misdemeanors.
The offenses are still occurring, the crimes are still occurring. We do not have the resources to prosecute all the offenses that come in the door, and so we have to prioritize.
Simply put, some alleged offenders are not being held accountable. It makes sense. Prosecutors are going to focus on putting murderers behind bars ahead of car thieves. But that means some cases are not prosecuted at all, or the criminal charges are resolved in other ways, like plea agreements, which are easier for prosecutors to deal with, but sometimes come with lighter sentences.
When we resolve a case, it is a very hard conversation to have with a victim of any type of crime, no matter what the crime is, but any victim, that you're unable to prosecute this case to the full extent of the law because you don't have the resources to do it.
To fix this, Governor Bill Walker is asking the legislature for more than $1 million to add 5 state prosecutors based in Anchorage, Bethel, and Kotzebue. One of the positions is a statewide drug prosecutor. Longtime Anchorage Assistant District Attorney Kathleen Runnels has already been hired to fill that role. She'll focus on large-scale drug dealers fueling Alaska's opioid epidemic. Runnell says she will be targeting the traffickers who bring drugs to Alaska.
We're seeing a spike in different crimes, and a lot of that leads back to the drugs that are being brought into the state. You sort of see this ripple effect in that crimes across the board tend to go up. Theft crimes, burglaries, vehicle thefts, shooting violence are all connected to drugs.
The Department of Law says this kind of targeted effort is desperately needed. But while prosecutors try to keep pace with rising crime, so too has the Public Defender Agency, which represents people charged with crimes who can't afford private defense attorneys. State Public Defender Quinlan Steiner says the lawyers in his office are already struggling with their own heavy caseloads. If more prosecutors means more charges filed, and there are still the same number of public attorneys available, Steiner says that too is a problem.
Well, it will certainly create a bottleneck, as we are unable to meet with clients and assist them in their cases in a timely manner. And we're starting to see that now.
The governor has requested more funding for the Public Defender Agency, along with the additional prosecutor positions. But it remains to be seen what the legislature includes as it crafts its state operating budget. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Opponents and advocates of mining in the Bristol Bay region are weighing in on the recent Environmental Protection Agency announcement regarding the proposed Pebble Mine. Administrator Scott Pruitt announced in late January the agency will suspend its withdrawal of Obama-era proposed protections for the Bristol Bay watershed. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
The EPA announced January 26 that it will suspend the process of withdrawing Obama-era proposed restrictions on mining in Bristol Bay. In other words, a proposed Clean Water Act determination that could give the EPA the power to veto the proposed Pebble Mine could still be finalized in the future. For now, the Pebble project can continue through normal permitting process with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Pruitt's announcement has opponents of mining in the region celebrating. Norman Van Bachter is the chief executive officer of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation.
Given what all of us have perceived have been some of the actions, very negative environmental actions, that the Environmental Protection Agency has taken since the new administration has come into office, that this was a breath of fresh air. And I think it still, more than ever, probably mandates and dictates that we can't let our guard down, that we really have to remain vocal.
Remaining vigilant and vocal is a common theme among the region's mining opponents. Mertis Evalt is the interim executive director for Nunamta Alukastai, an association of Bristol Bay tribes and village corporations.
We as a region, Bristol Bay, need all to work together and still keep our voices spoken to EPA and DNR and all of them, stating that we don't want this mine in Bristol Bay, the headwaters of our pristine fisheries.
Some in the region are less enthusiastic about the EPA's decision. The Alaska Peninsula Corporation, Iliamna Natives Limited, Kichik Corporation, and Tenalian Incorporated put out a joint statement. These corporations own land near or adjacent to the Pebble deposit and represent 1,500 shareholders. They called on Pruitt to ensure a full and fair review for the project, something that they're concerned a Clean Water Act determination could impede. The statement also says that mining exploration activities in the region have been significant for shareholders and contributed to sustainable communities. The statement supports the normal permitting process, but not explicitly the development of the Pebble project. Brad Ingeson is the Alaska Peninsula Corporation's Vice President of Corporate Affairs.
We stand in support of due process and will evaluate the project based on the merits of the application process and not based on political interference or pressure.
The Pebble Limited Partnership took a measured tone, saying that the permitting process for the proposed mine is still on track and that it believes it can construct a mine that meets Alaska's high environmental standards. The terms of a 2017 settlement stipulate that the EPA cannot finalize a Clean Water Act determination associated with mining the Pebble deposit until 2021, or until the EPA publishes a notice in the Federal Register of the final environmental impact statement regarding Pebble's permit application. The Army Corps of Engineers has initiated the process of developing an EIS for the Pebble project. As a part of that process, the Corps will host public meetings to solicit input on the project this spring. The dates and locations of those meetings will likely be announced in March. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
The Alaska court system is reviewing its policies to prevent sexual harassment. That's according to Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice Craig Stowers. He spoke to the legislature today in the annual State of the Judiciary address.
You know, we learn some stuff in kindergarten usually, and this is one of those things, and it still is hard to believe in this day and age that you would see the kind of instances of sexual harassment in the workplace or anywhere. There's no place for it in public life, and you know that, and I know that.
Stowers says he's forming a working group to examine the harassment policies. He says he isn't aware of any cases of harassment by judges or court employees. Stowers also talked about other changes to the court system, including changes to rural courts. They include adjusting court hours and staffing to match smaller caseloads, and the system plans to hire more non-law-trained deputy magistrate judges in rural areas. Stowers says they will handle uncomplicated judicial work. The changes will save $400,000. Stowers quoted the Star Wars character Yoda in encouraging the legislature to address the state's ongoing budget crisis.
The operative idea is that notwithstanding your differences, you must act. Do or do not. There is no try.
Stowers also requested that the legislature convert a district court judge position in Juneau to a superior court judge position to help handle the workload. It was Stowers' last address of a three-year term. The court will vote for a new chief justice before Stowers' term ends on June 30th. He will remain on the court. Last night, House District 38 Democrats took their first step toward replacing Representative Zach Fansler, who resigned last week amidst assault allegations. The caucus selected Ben Anderson Agamuk to chair their local party. He's a 25-year-old from Tununak and Bethel, who is Fansler's former aide, and his first job will be to replace him. Anderson Agamuk wouldn't comment on Fansler's resignation. He still works for the legislature and thought that would be inappropriate. But he did say what he's looking for in Fansler's replacement. He wants a candidate who would vote with the Democrats' majority coalition in the state house and who would be willing to run for re-election in 6 months in what could be a grueling campaign.
There would be a lot of village traveling. You know, your campaign will be as tough as your opponent, and we don't know what we have in store.
Governor Walker needs to select Fansler's replacement by March 14th. Before that happens, the House District 38 Democrats need to nominate three prospective candidates for him to review. That will be done by a selection committee, a panel of four or five District 38 constituents. They couldn't select the committee without a party chair. So the next step in the process will be for Anderson Agamuk to accept applications from potential committee members, which he will forward to the state's Democratic Party for review. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists keep an eye on invasive species in the Bering Sea.
Without a consistent monitoring program, how will we ever be able to detect the species when they arrive?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Olympics begin this week in South Korea, and the United States always has had a strong showing in the Winter Games, but not in cross-country skiing. The U.S. women's team has never won a medal. A skier from Alaska came close in Sochi 4 years ago, and since then, U.S. women have been racking up big wins at international races. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell reports the team hopes to make history in 2018.
It's a bright and cold training day before heading to South Korea, and a handful of Olympic athletes are here in the snowy mountains near Anchorage, Alaska. Keegan Randall pushes one ski and glides on the other, like she's skating on ice. Randall is 5'5" and all muscle, but this five-time Olympian doesn't take herself too seriously.
What's up with the pink hair?
You know, the pink hair is going on about 12 years now.
For decades, she says it was downhill skiers like Peekaboo Street and Lindsey Vonn claiming the skiing spotlight.
And I was kind of frustrated at the time because cross-country skiing was kind of pushed off as this, oh, you guys just wear spandex and you disappear off in the woods and it's kind of a lame sport. And I was like, no, like sprint racing's coming up. We're like really fast and dynamic. And so I thought, I want to show the fun side. So I put some pink tips in my hair.
With pink tips in her hair and multiple podiums in international races under her belt, Randall's time came to shine 4 years ago at the Winter Olympics in Sochi.
I was sitting in the stands right next to the finish line.
Peggy Shin is a sports journalist and author of a book about the women's cross-country ski team.
And I was all excited because this was going to be the race where the U.S. was going to win a medal.
Women's cross-country skiing made its Olympic debut in 1952, but the American women didn't even field a team until 1972. Since many of these races take place in their backyard, the Scandinavians have dominated the sport. In 2014, though, the American women were set to earn their first Olympic medal. In the quarterfinals of a sprint race, Keegan Randall lunged across the line.
And there was this amazing hush that went over the crowd, and nobody was like, nobody breathed for a few seconds when they realized what had happened. Like, Keegan Randall was not advancing to the semifinals.
That's the beauty of the Olympics and also the agony. It's one day. And if it doesn't quite go right, That's your chance.
Randall still chokes up when she talks about Sochi. But another beauty of the Olympics, they come around every 4 years. And the American team is deeper now. Spending months together racing in Europe every year means they're closer than most teams. And they're more confident than ever.
We definitely have a chance at a medal.
Jessie Diggins has been racking up her own set of medals at international races, like this one in Finland last year.
To the line they come. Jessie Diggins of the United States gets the bronze for the U.S.
Once across the line, Diggins collapses, sprawling out on the snow, skis still attached.
That's probably the best feeling there is.
A feeling the American women could replicate for the first time ever on the Olympic stage.
And that just gives me goosebumps because I know that we are coming into this with a serious fighting chance and we're going to be swinging hard.
The American women will come out swinging at their first of 6 cross-country ski races on Saturday. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
Temperatures again dipped to extremes this morning along the Yukon Quest Trail between Circle and Dawson City. Eagle officially registered minus 40, with readings of 50 below or colder unofficially reported at low points elsewhere along the Yukon and 40 Mile rivers. The severe cold makes running and caring for dogs difficult, but it's not preventing Quest teams from making steady progress toward the halfway point at Dawson. Two-time past Quest champion Hugh Neff is traveling mid-pack this year. Neff says his wife took their top leaders on the shorter Quest 300. So he's conservatively running a mix of old-timers and newbies, an experience he likens to babysitting.
I'm watching a bunch of dogs looking around going, where the heck am I? But the older dogs totally know where they're going. So at the same time, they're looking around. My old guy up in front, who's twice, you know, he's a lot older than anyone, he's just digging in going, come on, I'll show you. So it's sort of fun to watch. I mean, the dogs are actually teaching each other more than me doing anything. So just try to keep it lighthearted and happy.
Another mid-pack musher, Quest rookie Severin Cathrie of Switzerland, says river conditions on the run into Eagle pose more of a challenge than the extreme temperatures.
Cold I'm used to, but not the ice. Like, that's the first time our team was on glare ice out there. But they did good so far. One little tangle, but we made it anyway.
Cathrie is one of 20 mushers still in the race and among several on the 150-mile run from Eagle to Dawson City. Quest front runner Alan Moore is expected to be the first into Dawson tonight. The city and borough of Juneau will ask state regulators to make the city a party to negotiations over the local electric utilities transfer to a Canadian power company. And it committed money for outside lawyers to make that happen. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
Juneau business owner Randy Sutak distributed stickers and leaflets to the more than 30 people attending Monday's committee meeting. He said the city needs to protect ratepayers.
If you don't have a seat at the table, or if you're not trying to ensure yourself a seat at the table, then there's no incentive for anybody to negotiate with you. In other words, you have to take what you get.
Alaska Electric Light and Power was bought in 2013 by Avista of Spokane. Avista is being acquired by Hydro One, one of Canada's largest power companies. But the acquisition requires approval by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, which has received public comments from customers and lawmakers concerned about rates and the fate of utility assets. The largest prize is Snetisham Hydroelectric Project. The federally built hydro complex was completed in the early 1970s and produces about two-thirds of Juneau's electricity. It's owned by the state of Alaska, but AENLP has an option to acquire it. Mayor Ken Kelch said the hydro complex should remain publicly owned. That was a sentiment echoed by Assemblymember Jesse Keel, who said he worried a piece of critical infrastructure could become collateral for an out-of-state corporation.
We just don't know who will control the corporate board in Spokane 50 years from now, when Snetisham's turbines will still be spinning. So by and large, old hydro is cheaper than new hydro, or newly bonded, rebonded hydro. So I think the mayor's language is the best protection for Juneau's ratepayers in the long term.
AELNP President Connie Holbert also attended the meeting. After conferring with higher-ups, she released a statement that said her company supports the RCA's process because it gathers public input and protects the public interest.
We're confident that the merger on the horizon for Avista will not negatively impact AELNP or Juneau, and that AELNP will continue to operate as we do today, where we make local decisions to serve our customers.
Holbert added that many of the questions and concerns expressed by the public and members of the Assembly will be addressed in a forthcoming filing with the RCA. The Assembly Committee set aside $75,000 for expected legal fees. The Assembly also tasked the city manager to negotiate with Hydro One to secure a deal that could make a formal intervention unnecessary. It'll be up to the RCA to decide whether the city will be a formal party to the process. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Find out how you can include a gift to your public radio station through estate planning. Ask your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Invasive species haven't made the Bering Sea their home, at least not yet. But with rising temperatures and increased shipping traffic, scientists are working to assess the threats and the places these species would be most likely to settle. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more.
The Bering Sea is far away and cold. Native species are well adapted to living in the challenging environment, but increased shipping means there are more opportunities for invasive species to hitch a ride in. And as the waters warm, the ecosystem will become more hospitable, making it easier for them to settle. Zoologist Jessica Reimer is part of a team studying the threat.
And so what we really wanted to do was look at what invasive species have the potential to arrive. We wanted to know where should we be looking for them, so what ports are getting a lot of traffic. And then we wanted to look at if a species arrives, can it survive?
The reason to focus on the Bering Sea was twofold. First, there aren't really invasives there yet. And second, it's one of the largest commercial fisheries in the world and serves as a link to the Arctic. For the past 3 years, the team at the Alaska Center for Conservation Science has been compiling data to identify the largest threats. At the top of the list, researcher Amanda Giorgini says, are species that are geographically nearby, reproduce quickly, change their environment, or are in direct competition with existing species. One of the biggest threats is the European green crab.
The European green crab just tends to be a very voracious, very hungry predator with a high reproductive rate.
While the green crab can survive in the Bering Sea right now, Reimer says it can't reproduce.
So it's not warm enough for them to have offspring and for those offspring to survive and grow and become adults and go on to reproduce themselves. But when we do look at the climate models and we look in the future, we see that as things are warming up, we jump over this threshold where European green crab weren't able to reproduce, whereas now it opens up so that they can.
Removing invasives once they've taken root is challenging on land, but it is especially difficult in marine environments. So the researchers believe taking a proactive approach will help keep non-native species at bay. Ideally, all of Alaska's coastline would be monitored. Scientists would keep tabs of what organisms exist in a given area and look for changes. And Giorgini says there is some monitoring right now being done in Dutch Harbor, Nome, and the Pribilof Islands, but the efforts are patchy and dependent on funding.
Without a consistent monitoring program, how will we ever be able to detect the species when they arrive? And we know that the earlier we detect them, the greater chance we have of eradicating them.
The next step for the science is fine-tuning the modeling to imagine if invasives arrive, how they might spread through the Bering Sea, and might interact with the existing ecosystem. Without strict international regulations, ships may continue to knowingly or unknowingly transport non-native species wherever they travel. The Bering Sea has kept invasives at bay for now, but warming waters look to make it a more welcoming environment. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Washington state officials have proposed a new tack to save the Pacific Northwest critically endangered orca population. Their idea is to boost salmon hatchery production by 10 to 20 million more fish per year to provide more food for the iconic killer whales. No one wants to see orcas starve, but reliance on fish hatcheries leaves some whale advocacy groups uneasy. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports.
There are just 76 orcas left in the pods that call the inland waters of the Northwest home. Numerous factors take the blame for the dwindling population, but one of the biggest, according to biologists, is lack of prey. Chinook salmon are the preferred food for these orcas. Sport fisherman Greg King can relate.
The science is there. They're dying. We're on a world stage here right now. The whole world's watching us. Are we going to let these orca whales die and have that blood on our hands? I don't think we want that.
King trooped to the Washington legislature this month to support spending tax dollars to increase hatchery production of king salmon. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife first proposed this idea, and the governor is running with it. A state representative independently put forward the concept and is getting traction with both parties in the legislature. On one level, the idea is pretty simple. Rear more salmon at maybe half a dozen existing hatcheries throughout the state with spare capacity and release them.
So we're out here where the saltwater meets the adult ponds.
State Fish and Wildlife Regional Hatchery Manager Rob Allen shows me around the Hoodsport Salmon Hatchery on Hood Canal, where some of this might happen.
We want to see if we can add to that prey base here from Hoodsport.
And do you think this will work? I mean, because the fish in the end have to be pretty big by the time the killer whales go for them.
Well, we're hoping so. That's all we know is that we release fish, they go out to the salt, then they come back, and so then it's up to the whales to go ahead and eat them. So we think it's going to help.
But potential complications abound. The federal government will need to give the okay because both the Puget Sound orcas and many wild salmon runs they used to feed on are listed as endangered.
Hatchery fish have been identified as a bit detrimental to recovery of wild stocks. So they want us to put the reins on it a bit.
That's because hatchery fish could compete for resources with wild stocks and they might interbreed. So it'll be a challenge to identify the right salmon stocks, hatchery locations, and run timing.
Where do we need to emphasize, you know, a Chinook or a Chum salmon? Where do they need to be when these whales are there? And also, and where are we not going to have this greatest impact on wild fish? So it's a real juggling match.
Environmental groups are the most wary of the orca food pantry concept as it proceeds through the legislature, though they're not opposed. Darcy Nonnemaker handles government affairs for the Washington Environmental Council.
I think given the urgency with orcas and the critical need for food to be available to sustain orca populations, everything is on the table. At the same time, we do not want to have hatcheries done in a way that undermines listed salmon and other species that the orca eat, in particular Chinook salmon.
The president of the Orca Conservancy, another group, says using hatcheries to feed the orcas should only be a short-term solution until wild runs rebound. The governor's office says it may take years to figure out if the supplemental feeding strategy works, so they've penciled in indefinite funding. One way to measure results would be to collect and dissect orca poop to see what they ate. Easier said than done. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Teresa Katsourilis in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zoe Rome in Eagle, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
support comes from Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.